You know, the other night I went to the video store and rented a new movie that has just come out that I thought would be fun for my kids to watch. I talked to a couple of people and they'd said it was a fun movie, and certainly it was. It's called Bedtime Stories. Don't know if you've seen that movie, but it's just kind of a new Disney movie that's come out about these two kids and their uncle, and kind of one of those typical storylines where the distant uncle becomes best friends with the kids. And again, nothing particularly wrong with the movie. It's a PG, I think, and a nice little movie to watch. But as Brooke and I were watching the movie with our children, we were rather disappointed in just some of the themes that were played out in the movie. Again, oddly enough, no themes that I can put my finger on as necessarily, oh my gosh, I wish I hadn't had my kids see that. But just some underlying ideologies that came out through the movie that I frankly don't want my children to buy into. So it was a nice movie to watch once. It's not a movie I'm going to go and buy and have my children watch over and over again, like some of the movies they've watched so many times now they've memorized them. Because in this particular movie, one of the particular themes that played out that I thought was just something my kids don't need to be worrying about right now was the theme of love. There were these kids, and one of them's a little boy. And as the movie plays out, this idea of having a little girlfriend came up. There was this girl he kind of liked, and they kind of encouraged him in the whole deal. And then, you know, as you're talking about liking a boy or a girl, you start talking about kissing, and all the stuff just sort of unfolds. And it got me thinking and realizing again how early on in our culture we start inundating our children with the ideas that the world presents to us about what dating and sexuality and marriage ought to look like as we pursue this process. And as you start thinking about the starting point at Bedtime Stories and you start playing it out into the rest of culture and what it communicates, it's actually an extraordinary thing what we keep hearing. You know, you go all the way from the children's movies and the bedtime story type of thing, and you jump to the romantic comedies, right? And the romantic comedies start throwing out to us all sorts of ideas about what dating and marriage should look like. Ideas that play out in our minds subtly, even though we don't know that we necessarily buy into them. You know, Sleepless in Seattle. I reached out and touched her hand, and it was magic. That's right. So love is magic, and love is soulmates, and all these things that kind of tend to filter their way into our system. You jump from the romantic comedies into things like Sex and the City or things like Desperate Housewives, and you're in a whole nother level of communication about what life is really like in the dating world and in the marriage world. You step into the world of magazines like Cosmopolitan and teen magazines that speak to our teenagers about what dating and life should look like, what marriage should look like, and it blows the mind what kind of stuff is being written and shared with us about that. You know, as the world presents their plan to us, they present a very interesting plan to us. What are they really telling us? What are they really saying about dating and about sexuality and about marriage? Well, they're saying a lot, but here's a couple of things I've picked up on over the years as I've watched movies and read magazines. Here are some of the things that they're telling us. They're telling us it's not cool unless you have a boyfriend or girlfriend, and the younger you get one of those, the cooler you are. They say that it's not really cool until you get physical with that boyfriend or girlfriend. If you haven't kissed anyone by the time you're in middle school, you are weird. If you haven't slept with somebody by the time you're at the end of the high school, you can be in a comedy reality show. They tell us that love is magical, that it only lasts if you find your soulmate. They tell us that you should shop around a whole bunch. Since few people ever find their soulmate, it's really important that you shop around enough until you find your soulmate. And the only way you'll know that they're your soulmate is if you date them long enough to figure out that the love that was magical that started doesn't die away. And if it does die away, well, break up with them, because thank goodness you figured that out before you got married and had it die away in your marriage. They also tell us that if you're in a marriage that's not emotionally and physically intimate and vibrantly so, then you are one of the normal people. If you're in a marriage that's vibrant, emotionally and physically intimate, you're the exception to the rule. You're one of the lucky ones. You're one of the ones that might have found your soulmate. And then they pack on top of that lie this one, where the world tells us, don't let a loveless marriage keep you from true love with another. If you're in a marriage and love has faded and it's gone, well, then you should go out and find your real soulmate. Get out of that marriage and find someone else. And if you're not out of the marriage, when you find someone else, go ahead and test the waters with them. And if they turn out to be your soulmate, well, then move on in the direction of moving out of your marriage. So obviously, as we hear those things, we go, wow, we think those things are wrong because we're sitting here in church. But the reality is that logically in our mind, some of those things really do play out. And they really do become systems we believe in. We sit in our marriages that are emotionally and physically struggling. And we wonder in the back of our minds, I wonder if I'm with the wrong person. I wonder if this person's my soulmate. I wonder where we went wrong. You know, many of us who are single, we buy into the fact that God says we should hang out and wait for him to do things. But yet every day, we struggle with the idea of just finding someone. And what does God really say about this whole thing of marriage and sexuality and even beginning the journey in a dating relationship? Well, in order to discover that, we got to start at the very beginning. We got to start where God first created the institution and covenant of marriage. And we start beginning to get a sense of how incredibly, deeply important this institution and this covenant is as God sees it. In Genesis chapter 1 and 2, God is creating the world. And at the end of the creation process, he creates man and woman. But before he creates woman, he creates man. And everything is good in creation until he gets to this point and he creates man. And he says that it is not good for man to be alone. In Genesis chapter 2 and verse 18, he says, the Lord said, it is not good for the man to be alone. I will make a helper suitable for him. In the rest of that passage, God sends all of creation past man to determine if anybody was a helpful suitor for him, and nobody is found. And so it says in verse 20, but for Adam, no suitable helper was found. So the Lord God caused the man to fall into a deep sleep. And while he was sleeping, he took one of man's ribs and closed up the place with flesh. Then the Lord God made a woman from the rib he had taken out of man, and he brought her to the man. And the man said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, for she was taken out of man. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh. The man and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame. Here God establishes for us this incredibly intimate relationship between two human beings, a husband and wife, a man and a woman that have come together, and they are literally one flesh. Their individual stories become one story, and their lives become an intimate example of what relationship can and should look like. And as we look into Genesis, we see God taking it even further as humanity starts expanding, and especially after sin entered the world, after that beautiful picture began and man and woman left the garden. God, as he's giving his law to mankind in the book of Exodus, makes some very specific statements. You guys have all heard of the Ten Commandments, I know that, and the Ten Commandments are interesting because God gave a tremendous amount of law throughout the books of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, and then certainly throughout the rest of Scripture. But of all of that, he selected 10 specific points to kind of bring a clarity of some very important things to him. And in the list of those 10 commandments, here are two of the commandments that he puts. One, he says, you shall not commit adultery. And another command, he says, you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. Very interesting that God decides here in the list of 10 commandments, out of the 10, two of them deal with this idea of marriage. Do not commit adultery and do not covet another man's wife. Now, what is adultery? Now, we can pull out definitions from the dictionary and we can pull out definitions from the Bible. But the reality is, as I say the word, every one of us here knows what that means, right? That means when you decide to connect with somebody that is not your spouse in a way that is only appropriate to connect with your spouse. Adultery can find its way into an emotional connection where you are emotionally connecting with a person of the opposite sex that is not your spouse when you should be emotionally connecting on that level with your spouse. It can take a physical form where you're connecting physically with somebody, doing physical things with them that are inappropriate, that should only be appropriate with your spouse. And that's when we begin to step into the world of adultery, where we are giving ourselves away to another in a manner that belongs exclusively to our husband or wife. And God says in his top 10, do not do that. It is not good. God goes on in the Song of Solomon, which Solomon wrote, to describe a relationship between a man and a woman that is absolutely extraordinary. And it is one of the most beautiful books to read if you ever want to sit with your husband or wife and read through a book that will reinfuse into your marriage some incredible things. Read the book of Song of Solomon. So we know that God is not only laying out about marriage just simple commands, he is giving us an entire book that describes the incredible intimacy of that relationship and the vibrancy that that relationship can and should take. And he encourages us into that kind of vibrancy. And then it culminates in the book of Ephesians in chapter 5. And I kind of want you to turn there with me to Ephesians chapter 5 in verse 22, where God culminates this idea of marriage in a very particular and very specific way that enlightens us into why, from Genesis, God has taken marriage so incredibly serious. First, he begins by speaking to wives and husbands about how we ought to act in our marriages. And he says this in verse 22, wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife as Christ is the head of the church, his body of which he is the Savior. Now, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. In this same way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. After all, no one ever hates his own body, but he feeds and cares for it just as Christ does the church, for we are members of his body. And then he says, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So here he is describing to us a marriage that has nothing to do with magic and nothing to do with soulmates. It's got to do with two people that dedicate themselves to the betterment and the building up of the other person in the relationship. This is all about a man making himself who he needs to be in order to be the kind of man that will better his wife. And it's all about a wife who makes herself who she needs to be so that she can better her husband. This isn't even a passage about the needs that we have and how we ought to demand those. This is a passage about us giving ourselves away for the sake of another. This is how God describes a love relationship, an intimate relationship in a marriage. And the true clue to why he takes so much meticulous time to describe to us why it is so important to guard this relationship that he established, that he called marriage, we find right here in this passage of Ephesians as he closes this out. In Ephesians 32, the very next verse after which we just read, says this, "This is a profound mystery." That is this mystery about husbands and wives. "But I'm not talking about Christ and the church." I'm sorry, I just missed that. There you go. "But I am talking about Christ and the church." See, look what he says. "This is a profound mystery, but I am talking about Christ and the church. I'm not talking about husbands and wives." And then he just throws in a parenthesis in verse 33. However, each one of you also must love his wife as he loves himself, and the wife must respect her husband. It's almost as though Paul is saying, I've just described to you the incredible importance of the marriage relationship. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. Wives, submit to your husbands. But the reality is that this mystery is not about the marriage. It is about the relationship that Christ has with us, the church. The mystery is that Christ has made himself groom and he has made us the church bride. And he describes his relationship with us in the same way that he describes our relationship with one another as a married couple. He demonstrates to us that the intimacy that he established between a husband and wife in Genesis, that he confirmed in Exodus in the Ten Commandments, that he solidified in the book of Song of Solomon by demonstrating that intimacy to us, and then that he culminates in the book of Ephesians by calling us into a way we ought to love and ought to demonstrate that relationship. In doing all of that, he does it because he loves us like a husband should love his wife, and we ought to love him like a wife loves her husband. Do you realize that God has decided in his ultimate wisdom that the relationship on this planet that will best describe our relationship with Jesus and his love for us is the relationship of husband and wife? Is it any wonder to you that the enemy of God, if he wants to destroy one relationship on this planet, is going to focus on making sure that he destroys the intimacy and love between a husband and wife so that that relationship will fall apart and so that the world will never be able to truly know the relationship between Jesus and his church because their best example of that will be a mess. Do you realize that as we sit here in this room, that in our Western culture, the divorce rate is now exceeding 50%. That means more than half the marriages that start fail in divorce. And do you realize that that equation in of itself isn't even the worst news? Of the few marriages that survive the divorce rate, if you take what's left, that other 50%, certainly 50% of those marriages are not marriages that are worth anything. They have lost all sense of vibrance and love. They're simply together because divorce isn't a good option for them. These are the marriages where they're sleeping in separate bedrooms. They're not talking to each other. They have no real relationship. They coexist, roommates at best. Of the 25% now that we have left, if we took that and we divided that into 50%, there are 50% of those marriages that I'm sure exist in some level of intimacy, but have no real vibrancy. Yes, they still love each other. Yes, they still are polite to each other, and they still have some sense of relationship. They're still friends. They may even be good friends. But the intimacy of marriage has left that place. And then when you take the few that are left, you divide that by 50%, and you've got some good marriages. You got good marriages. They're doing well. They're moving forward. They're committed to each other. They're not gonna leave. They've got some exciting things going on. But the vibrancy and the excitement that exists in emotional and physical and spiritual intimacy that drives day for day, this is your best friend, the person that you are most connected with, that isn't quite there. I mean, what are we left with? We're left with a small percentage of marriages that still demonstrate the kind of vibrancy that Song of Solomon talks about. I mean, if we really want to be honest and we read Song of Solomon, I bet the percentage of marriages that exist like Song of Solomon are very, 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 very small, both in and outside the church. So I would say if the enemy's task was to make sure that marriages were no longer the picture of Christ's love for his church, I think he's doing a very, very effective job. And we need to be aware of that so that we understand how to stand up against that kind of job. So what is he doing? How is he lying to us so well? Well, as Satan always does, as he did in the garden with Eve and with Adam, he has a way of taking truth, presenting it to us, saying, look, this is what God says, then twisting that truth just enough so it's no longer truth and perverting it so that we live outside of that truth. Let's see what he's done here. There is a truth that starts in Genesis, right? God said, it is not good for man to be alone. That is a truth that God laid out for us. Satan comes along and he whispers in our ear before we get to middle school, it is not good for man to be alone. You should not be alone. You need a soulmate. You need a boyfriend or a girlfriend. And so out of his mouth, through our culture, through our media, through our world, through what we think, through the way we look at stuff, he begins to whisper to us from a young age that it is not good for you to be alone. You ought to find intimacy and you ought to find it fast. And so we jump into relationships right off the bat because we don't want to be alone. And when we are alone, we are outcasts in our society because he says, oh, but this is what God says. Well, he takes that further, doesn't he? He says, look, because it's not good to be alone, and frankly, if you are alone, you are not significant. You have no significance because being alone on this planet is if you don't have a human being intimately connected with you. God certainly is not going to fulfill your needs because he's invisible. God designed it that way. I mean, look at Genesis, husband, wife. God didn't talk about himself there. So if you are going to stay significant, you need to make sure you stay with somebody. And so he whispers into the next lie. And he says to us, in order to stay in a state of not being alone, you need to make sure you keep the person with you. So your job is to become whoever you need to be to keep them in the relationship. Now, if you're going to do that, they need to know that you love them. And the only way we demonstrate love effectively, I mean, look at Song of Solomon, is by giving ourselves an intimacy physically and emotionally to somebody. So you better start getting physical and you better start getting emotional and you better do it fast. Because if you don't, they'll figure out you don't love them and then they'll leave and then you'll be alone again. And so we do. We give ourselves away physically, emotionally, in huge ways, because we have been whispered to and said being alone is very bad. And if you don't love somebody, then they'll leave you. That unfolds into the third lie that he whispers to us. And he says, listen, just so you know, if somebody leaves you because love wasn't working, it just means they weren't your soulmate. So don't stop there. Don't get discouraged. Don't think that you're left by yourself. Keep looking, because love is magical. And if there's no magic, there's no love. So as soon as the magic fades, the love is gone. Get out and get out fast. And then he whispers to us, shop around. Don't give up. If love fades in one, that's okay. Keep shopping, because at some point, if you keep giving yourself away and you keep becoming physically and emotionally intimate with different people and you keep spending yourself, at some point, you're going to find your soulmate. And then everything will be worth it because, hey, love is magical. And anyways, let's be honest. This whole thing with the soulmate is probably the most important relationship you'll have on this planet. And you wouldn't go out and buy a car without test driving it. So you need to make sure that as you spend time with all these people that could be your soulmates, that you test and approve that everything in the relationship works well, because if it doesn't, they're not your soulmate. So if, for instance, you are physically intimate with somebody only after you get married, then you're in trouble, because what if you discover then that you're not compatible and then you have to go back and it's real inconvenient to get out of a marriage? It's much easier just to get out of a dating relationship. So figure that stuff out there so you don't have to worry about it later. Because after all, if you take a car for a test drive, you figure out whether you like it or not, then you buy it. Nobody buys a car without test driving it. Why on earth would we marry somebody without taking them for a test drive? He takes that lie further, doesn't he? That's if we're single. But if we're married, then the second we get married, he starts whispering to us, do they still love you? Do you still love them? Is everything still working? I mean, let's be honest. The vibrancy that you had before you got married, the excitement that existed, where has it gone? I mean, do you remember what it was like to be emotionally and physically intimate before you were married? I mean, there was such a sense of excitement, such a sense of stuff happening. I mean, you remember when you were doing things that you kind of knew you shouldn't be doing, but it just felt good? Well, where's all that gone? As soon as you have your first child and you go through the first pregnancy and then the first 9 months after that pregnancy and all the complications of pregnancy and childhood enter into the marriage, boy, he starts whispering loudly, doesn't he? Oh my gosh, what happened to the marriage? And before you know it, we're sitting smack dab in the middle of Desperate Housewives and Sex in the City, and they're whispering to us around a table with a bunch of women going, oh my gosh, yeah, the last time we were intimate together was, woo, a long time ago. And we hear it, the whisper. If you're in a marriage that's vibrant, that's physically and emotionally intimate, you are the exception to the rule. Marriages don't last like that. Until you find your soulmate, but soulmates are few and far between, so you obviously didn't shop well enough. But don't worry, because if you find yourself in a marriage that has lost its vibrancy, we live in a society that has a way out. It's quick and easy. It's called divorce. And certainly you don't want to spend the rest of your life in a dead marriage. Why would you do that when your soulmate is waiting for you out there somewhere? So get out, move on. Better luck next time. And this time, before you get married, for crying out loud, shop around more. Give yourself away a little more, because you don't want to get stuck in another marriage where love fades because you didn't find your soulmate. Sounds good, doesn't it? Sounds almost right, doesn't it? The problem is that all of those lies, they don't lead to freedom in marriage. They lead to death in marriage. Because we learn lessons along the way. We pick up things along the way and we incorporate them into our marriages. And then our marriages start existing in a world of magic instead of a world of commitment. In a world of feelings instead of a world of decisions. And suddenly our marriage is on shaky ground. And suddenly we don't know where to go from there. See, God tells us, as you're preparing to get into marriage, take the time to learn to commit to things. Take the time to learn to become the person you need to be so that you are spending your life in your marriage becoming the person you need to be. Stop worrying so much about who they're going to be and start worrying about who you're going to be. God says, save yourself before you get married so that you can give yourself fully to your spouse. Because true love exists when the commitment is so strong that there is a freedom inside that commitment to be yourself. And that will never happen if your spouse perceives that she or he is still in the testing phase. So if you start a relationship in the testing phase, don't imagine that just because you put a ring on your finger, it will suddenly change to the commitment phase. God says to us, as a single person, guard yourself very, very carefully so that when you step into marriage, you step into marriage under the paradigm of commitment, not under the paradigm of selfish needs. If God were to whisper to us, he would say this. My enemy tells you that you would never buy a car without taking it for a test drive. So why would you get a wife or a husband without taking him or her for a test drive? And I tell you that every car you buy will eventually get old and you will sell it for another. A marriage is not a car. A marriage is a committed relationship between two human beings that says, until death does us part, we will stand with one another. I'm not interested in selling you for another. And that kind of relationship does not exist because you found the one you loved. It exists because you work at becoming the one she loves or he loves. We need to step into our marriages and not focus on ourselves, but focus on the other. And if you're going to do that in your marriage, then you better learn to do that before you're married. My dad used to tell me, Renaud, don't worry so much about what your wife is going to be like someday. Worry more about what you're going to be like for her and develop that. My dad told me when I was younger, Renaud, remember this, every single relationship you get into before you're married, if you are dating or you are courting a woman, everything you do to that woman, you are doing to another man's wife until you put a ring on her finger and she becomes your wife. Because let's face it, those are the truths we stand on, aren't they? Every test drive you take, every relationship you spend your time in, every time you give yourself away to another, everything you do to another person, emotionally, physically, spiritually, you are doing to another person's husband or wife unless you marry them. So what kinds of things are you pouring into those people that you are spending your time dating or courting that will develop them in a godly manner for whichever future spouse they're going to be part of? And what things are you doing to them that will steal away what truly belongs to their husband or wife? So what does this, all this mean to us? What does all this mean for us as we look at the practicalities of where we go from here? If at the end of the day, the marriage relationship is so critical because it is the relationship that best describes the intimacy and love that Jesus has for the world, and if we want to make sure as Christ followers, as the church, that our marriages are so vibrant and powerful and intimate that when somebody looks into them, they see what it would be like to be in relationship with Jesus, then we ought to guard our marriages with our lives, shouldn't we? I mean, we ought to make that one of the highest callings we have, is to guard our marriages. And that means we need to start guarding our marriages long before we get married. Instead of having a middle schooler being whispered to by this society saying, if you're alone as a middle schooler, you're not cool. And instead of telling a high schooler, if you haven't slept with your boyfriend or girlfriend, you're not cool. And instead of telling a 25-year-old, if you're still in relationship, I mean, if you're still not in a relationship with somebody at this point in your life, you are just missing the boat somewhere. And instead of making a 30-year-old feel weird because they've never given themselves away because they've never been married, let us step into a different world, a biblical world, and start telling our children and our young adults that are single the truth. Let's start reminding them, and may I remind you here tonight if you are single, that God calls us to develop friendships with people of the opposite sex. And when we find somebody that has all of the character qualities and the personality and the way that we think, boy, this person has become one of my best friends and it's the kind of person that I would want to be with, then we develop a courting relationship with them that starts developing spiritual intimacy, some emotional intimacy, some connections on that level, spending time together, spending time getting to know each other. And we stay away from the physical intimacy, which is reserved for a man and woman that become husband and wife. Everything you do to that person physically, you're doing to somebody else's spouse unless you marry them. So why do anything? Let me tell you, if you get yourself physically connected with a person as a single person, every time that relationship ends, you end up with a broken heart in a huge way. And you make a mess. Not just for that, but for the future marriage you're going to be part of and the future marriage they're going to be part of. And you have forgotten that it is your job as a Christ follower to guard marriage. You want to guard marriage as a single person? Develop intimacy with people of the opposite sex, spiritually and emotionally, and guard yourself physically. Because God tells us that the physical relationship is guarded for marriage. I mean, imagine if you walked into this church this next week, and I was in the lobby over there, and you walked past, and Brooke was in here, my wife, and there was some other woman out in the lobby, and I walked over to her, and I gave her a big kiss, and we started making out in the lobby. I mean, how would that make you guys feel? I mean, I'd feel uncomfortable. I hope you'd feel uncomfortable. And yet, we've determined in our minds that before we're married, it's okay to do that kind of stuff because we're not married yet. It's only not okay once we're married. But the reality is it doesn't change one bit in God's world, does it? What you're doing with somebody that is not your spouse, you're doing with somebody else's spouse unless they're your spouse. So as a rule of thumb, let me give you this rule of thumb. If you wouldn't do it with your spouse someday, don't do it with your boyfriend or girlfriend, period. And I'm not just talking about the physical, I'm talking about anything. If you wouldn't do it with your spouse in the picture, then don't do it with your spouse out of the picture. So just to be clear, I would not go and spend time with another woman at her place alone until midnight if my wife were home. So you ought not to be doing those kinds of things with somebody. Certainly, before you're married, the one thing God gives you freedom to do is to develop friendship and develop intimacy spiritually and emotionally with someone. Only if, though, you are in a process of working toward marriage with them. Don't test the waters with 30 different people. Be friends with a lot of people, like I am. I'm friends with a lot of women, but not intimately. And when you find someone that you determine could be a future spouse, then increase that intimacy spiritually and emotionally and see where it goes. But guard your marriage physically. If you're married here tonight, what do you do? Well, I'll tell you what you do. Whatever's missing in your marriage, start working on it. And don't wait for your spouse to jump in and do it. Marriage has never been about what our spouse does for us. It has always been about what we do for our spouse. If your marriage is lacking vibrancy, physical intimacy, emotional intimacy, if your marriage is lacking spiritual intimacy, don't sit around. Start being the catalyst for developing those things in your marriage. Wives, get into your marriage. Start giving yourself to the development of that marriage. Submit to your husband, yes, but submission is service. And serve your husband by guiding and leading him if he needs to be guided and leaded. Sometimes husbands who ought to be leading spiritually just aren't doing it. So help him do it. Sometimes husbands ought to be giving themselves more to a marriage. So help him do that by being a place he wants to come home to. Husbands, if you don't have a vibrant marriage, or your physical world is not intimate, or your emotional world is not connected, do something about it. But not your way. Do something about it her way. Develop a love relationship with her. Romance her. Win her back. I close with this thought for those of you that are married. I watched this movie a long time ago called 50 First Dates, and it's a fun movie, just a romantic comedy. But in this particular case, this romantic comedy made a great point at the end. Now, this romantic comedy laid out for us a story about a woman that had amnesia, and she'd lose her memory at the end of each day. And so this guy who really cared about her, he had to win her from morning till night every day, because by the time she went to bed, the next morning she'd forget who he was. So 50 first dates was the idea that over the first 50 dates he had, they were all first dates. And so it was his job to do all that he could each day to win her love within a 24-hour period of time. And I remember thinking to myself, what a fantastic idea that is, isn't it? What would your marriage look like if every morning when you woke up, you had the determination in your mind that today I was going to win the love of my spouse again? I mean, you did a great job when you were courting your spouse. But when did it stop? Well, may I challenge you as you leave here tonight that maybe you will go home and try to figure out today what it's going to take to win the heart of your spouse again. And you keep doing that every day. And husbands, if you keep doing that, you will not lack the vibrancy in marriage that you desire. And wives, if you keep doing that, you will not lack the intimacy in marriage that you desire. And your marriages will turn into the kinds of marriages that are a great reflection of Jesus Christ and his church. And so, both single and married in this church will begin to guard their marriages right now. And if we do that, we will see Jesus glorified in our marriages. Let's pray.